Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Caring for Your Bones When You Have Multiple Myeloma. This is a very important program, and it's one that we try to offer a few times a year just because it is so important for each of you. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the topic that we have over 569 participants on the call today. And you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, from all different regions of the country, and we also have international participants from Canada, India, Jamaica, Jordan, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. It's a really global call. Now, today's program was made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline that our speakers have prepared. There's also information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for each of you to be able to use going forward in terms of just getting free help with different issues or concerns you might have. There is an evaluation form as well, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you really can best tell us the programs you want us to offer? So we could come up with ideas, but they might not be the programs you'd like us to offer. So we take your recommendations very seriously, and we are planning a number of programs now for this whole 2012 year, and really look to you to tell us what you'd like us to offer. So take a moment and recommend the programs and topics of your choice, and we'll try very hard to implement them. Indeed, this particular topic is one that many of you have said, please do this over and over again, and so we try to as often as possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Nupur Rajay. Dr. Rajay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She's also Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Rajay is going to address an overview of multiple myeloma, including its effects on your bones, treatment options for multiple myeloma, reducing complications from bone disease, and clinical trials. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Rajay.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. So multiple myeloma, as you all know, is a cancer of the bone marrow, which is caused by cells called plasma cells. These plasma cells are a type of a white blood cell, which is important to the immune system. In the normal case, their function is to protect against infections by producing antibodies called immunoglobulins. Normally, plasma cells make up less than 5% of the blood cells in the bone marrow. But for reasons that are not completely understood, plasma cells can sometimes grow out of control, and then these are referred to as myeloma cells. These myeloma cells can then fill up the bone marrow and damage the bone. And over time, they can collect and form little tumors in multiple areas of the bones, which is where the name multiple myeloma comes from. Symptoms from myeloma may be a consequence of the presence of the protein in the blood or urine produced by these myeloma cells and or infiltration of the bone marrow by these myeloma cells. Symptoms of bone pain and anemia remain the most common presenting features affecting more than 80% of patients with myeloma. Other features may include symptoms related to either increased calcium levels, which is when calcium leaches out of the bones when bones get destroyed with the disease, kidney dysfunction, and infection. All of these symptoms will be corrected with the treatment of the underlying myeloma. In recent years, new medications which have been approved by the FDA have really transformed how this cancer is treated. These new drugs have now doubled the survival of our myeloma patients, and progress has been unprecedented compared to any other cancer subtype. New combinations with older drugs in combination with some of these new drugs are now proving to be very beneficial and useful for our patients. We typically do not recommend treatment for people with myeloma who have no symptoms. But once symptoms set in, then most physicians would treat a patient's myeloma. Multiple myeloma drugs, which are now available, help stop the growth of this cancer. And in nearly 100% of these patients, we're able to get them into some form of remission. Very encouragingly, the new drugs that we have now are able to get nearly 40 to 50% of our patients into what we refer to as a complete remission. Drugs such as thalidomide and lenalidomide belong to a category of drugs called immunomodulatory drugs. These agents are taken by mouth, and they have really helped transform myeloma into a chronic disease. Another class of drugs which is very important in the treatment of myeloma include the proteasome inhibitors, and an example of this is bortezomib or Velcade, which has shown significant responses and is being combined with both thalidomide and Velcade, where patients have now a nearly 100% response rate to this kind of treatment. Treatment of myeloma typically consists of an induction phase where all patients should be getting some form of a new drug. Choice of initial therapy is obviously based on several different features, such as patient characteristics, what are the disease subtypes, etc. This is generally followed by consolidation, and now more recently, we started using what's referred to as maintenance treatment. In younger patients with myeloma, transplant is considered as a consolidation approach. Typically, for myeloma, stem cells are taken from the patient himself or herself, and this is then referred to as an autologous stem cell collection. After harvesting these stem cells, the patient gets high doses of chemotherapy, destroy whatever myeloma is still left in the bone marrow, and these stem cells are then transplanted to the patient, which grow into healthy blood cells, forming new blood and a new immune system. Maintenance treatment typically follows either the initial induction treatment for those folks who haven't had a transplant or generally is done post-transplant. This has now become a very feasible approach, and part of the reason for this is that the drugs we have available for myeloma right now are very well tolerated, and a lot of them are given by mouth. A recent trial, in fact, has demonstrated that once you've had a transplant and then been maintained on lenalidomide, patients' myeloma is controlled for prolonged periods of time and people actually live longer as well. More recently, we are also using the proteasome inhibitor or bortezomib, which is being considered in the same setting where we give it every other week. Again, bortezomib is also, in the old days, used to be given by vein, but now we have newer methods of giving it, and one of the methods is by giving it just under the skin, which is much, much, much better tolerated. Bone disease, as I have already mentioned, affects the majority of patients with myeloma. If untreated, this can result in a lot of complications and really does impact the quality of life of our patients. What has really changed this is the use of bisphosphonates for the treatment of multiple myeloma-related bone disease. And the drugs which we commonly use here are either pimidronate or zoledronic acid, and these are generally recommended for anybody who is getting actively treated for their myeloma. These bone-strengthening agents have proven in randomized trials to decrease incidence of complications, which include pain, fractures, need for radiation, and sometimes a need for surgical interventions as well. Most recently, there's been a large randomized trial which was done in the UK, which has actually demonstrated benefits even in terms of patients living longer when they've been treated with the bisphosphonate zoledronic acid. There are certain other local measures which can be very useful in the treatment of myeloma patients, and these include procedures such as vertebral augmentation procedures. They're typically referred to as vertebroplasties or kyphoplasties. They're pretty good at controlling pain in patients with myeloma. But I think the most important intervention for a myeloma patient is really treatment of the underlying myeloma in itself. And what's been remarkable in the last several years is these novel agents not only treat the myeloma, but they've also shown a positive impact on bone disease specifically. And thinking about these novel drugs, drugs like bortezomib or Velcade have certainly shown that they can not only help with myeloma, but they can in fact help with bone healing as well. We also have a whole bunch of exciting new novel agents, which we refer to as bone anabolic agents or bone formation agents, and these agents are now in very early clinical trials where hopefully we are going to start seeing healing of those myeloma lesions, which you see in most patients. Another drug which is going to be used or is going to be tested in myeloma patients, not that new, it has been tested in other solid tumors, is an antibody called denosumab. This is an antibody against a protein called RANK ligand, and this is able to block the effects of RANK ligand, which is a protein which causes bone destruction. We have an ongoing trial, and this trial, in fact, is accruing all over the world where patients are either going to get zoledronic acid versus denosumab, and the hope is that denosumab works just as well as zoledronic acid, or hopefully even does better in terms of efficacy. Again, given all of these novel agents that we have for myeloma, we've been fortunate into translating in this disease into a very chronic disease, but with that we are beginning to see certain long-term toxicities of these bisphosphonates, and one such toxicity is called osteonecrosis of the jaw. Dr. Peterson, who's going to be following after me, is going to address oral health in more detail. He's going to talk about ONJ as well, and we are doing certain clinical trials to address the issue of ONJ, where we're looking at less frequent dosing of bisphosphonates once patients are in remission. Obviously, we're very excited about these five FDA-approved drug combinations which we have. Combining lenalidomide and bortezomib with additional agents has really helped transform this disease into a chronic condition. But even more exciting, I believe, are some of the multiple novel targeted drugs which we have demonstrated anti-myeloma activity, some of them in very early laboratory-based studies and some of them in early clinical trials. The interesting ones right now are novel proteasome inhibitors, HDAC inhibitors, mTOR inhibitors, certain monoclonal antibodies. Amongst the proteasome inhibitors, the one which is kind of further most in its development is a drug called carfilzomib. It is very similar to Velcade and, in fact, has shown some nice responses even in people who have been refractory to Velcade. So this is a drug which hopefully will get approved for the treatment of multiple myeloma pretty quickly. A few other proteasome inhibitors, like the IMiDs, we have a whole bunch of oral proteasome inhibitors, so it's going to make life a lot easier, and instead of taking that injection either by vein or now bortezomib given under the skin, in the future we're going to start seeing some of these drugs being used by mouth. Another very interesting drug which is given by mouth belongs to the category of the IMiDs. So you had thalidomide, lenalidomide, and the newest kid on the block now is called pomalidomide. This has shown remarkable activity in people who had previously been treated with either lenalidomide or thalidomide. And hopefully we're going to see this drug approved as well. Amongst the HDAC inhibitors, the drugs which have been tested in clinical trials include panobinostat and vorinostat, which have been combined with Velcade. We have more selective HDAC inhibitors, which we are currently doing clinical trials with, one of them being ACY-1215 in combination with both Velcade and lenalidomide is in ongoing trials. Ultimately, I do believe it's going to be possible for us to carry out gene and protein expression profiling for each patient specifically, and we're then going to be able to allow selection of agents which are most likely going to to be benefiting that specific patient. And I think we've already started doing that in myeloma to some extent. And an example of this would be looking for what's called the BRAF mutation. Now, this is a mutation which is commonly seen in melanoma patients. Melanoma is a skin cancer, but what's interesting is that in myeloma patients, about 4 out of 100 myeloma patients have the same BRAF mutation. So as of right now, we are actually doing a clinical trial where we are looking at this BRAF mutation in our patients with myeloma, and if they do have that mutation, we'll be using a drug which specifically targets this mutation. There are certain other antibodies which are exciting, one of them being LY2127399. This is against a growth factor called B-cell activating factor. This is being combined with Velcade. Another one which is further along in its development is called elotuzumab. This is against a protein called CS1. It's a protein which is seen on the myeloma tumor cell, and so far the data looks very promising with both of these antibodies. There's a whole bunch of other antibodies, and because of timing, I'm not going to be able to go into all of them, but we can certainly address them later on. Obviously, because of the rapid evolution of all of these therapies and because of the availability of so many different clinical trials, you know, I cannot underscore the importance of you connecting with your healthcare providers, with your healthcare team, and really trying to determine whether or not you have some of these options available to you close to home and which, if any of these, would be appropriate for you. The other very important thing is, you know, we've been again extremely fortunate where we've been able to transform this into a chronic disease. But with that, you know, we are using these drugs for prolonged periods of time and we're seeing long-term toxicities. One of them I've mentioned is ONJ, the other one is neuropathy, and I know that Dr. Stubblefield later on is going to address some of these issues. So staying active, staying on top of your toxicities are very, very important to really have a good outcome with myeloma. I'm going to stop here, Carolyn. Thanks.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Rajay, for really setting a wonderful context for the whole program today, really going over all the details of myeloma for everybody, and doing such an excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Doug Peterson. And Dr. Peterson is Professor of Oral Medicine, Department of Oral Health and Diagnostic Sciences, School of Dental Medicine, Chair Program in Head and Neck Cancer and Oral Oncology, NAE Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is going to address the role of your dentist, dental care during treatment, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Peterson.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's my pleasure to be part of today's discussion. Thank you. First, I'd like to provide a brief overall context in relation to the role of the dentist in the management of the patient with myeloma. It's important to recognize that not all cancers, and certainly not all cancer treatments, cause mouth problems, including jawbone problems, either during or after the cancer therapy. This is certainly the case with the treatment of multiple myeloma. Secondly, there are excellent resources, such as those provided through cancer care to patients and their families and to the cancer team, to guide the decision-making and treatments of the mouth problems should those mouth problems develop. Third, the partnership that Dr. Raji talked about is very, very important. The partnership between the patient, the family, the healthcare team, this combination can result in very clear understandings and very effective treatment outcomes. And in turn, this can lead to excellent quality of life for many years to come. So with that context in relation to dental care, I'd like to now briefly discuss some of the key issues in relation to multiple myeloma and dental medicine. It's interesting that multiple myeloma can occur in the lower jaw of some patients. For example, it can sometimes cause jawbone pain that seems like a toothache or a gum infection. This is before the myeloma has been diagnosed medically and certainly before any medical treatment. The dentist can evaluate the basis for these toothache or gum-like symptoms and refer the patient to the physician when multiple myeloma is suspected. Then if the myeloma is ultimately diagnosed, it can be quite responsive to today's state-of-the-art cancer treatments, such as Dr. Raji described. Now, some of the cancer treatments for multiple myeloma can cause temporary changes in the mouth, including mouth sores or mucositis. These are not jawbone problems per se, so I'll defer on a detailed discussion of mucositis at this point. I would like to mention, though, that there are very good approaches to reducing the mouth sores and their soreness, as well as helping these areas in the mouth heal. We can certainly talk about this further during the question and answer session if that would be of interest to anyone. I'd like to now turn to the bony condition that Dr. Raji mentioned, osteonecrosis of the jaw, or ONJ. This can occur in a small percentage of myeloma patients receiving what we call a bone-modifying agent, such as one of the bisphosphonates that you heard about, or denosumab, to name two types. It's really important to understand that ONJ involves the development of exposed bone in either the upper or lower jaws or both in a small percentage of patients receiving medications such as bisphosphonates. In fact, the data will show over the past several years that over 90 to 95% of patients receiving these bone-modifying agents do not typically develop the complication. Thus, the risk of developing this jawbone problem is small. The vast majority of cases of ONJ so far have been associated with the use of so-called nitrogen-containing bisphosphonates, such as pinidronate or zoledronic acid that Dr. Raji mentioned. Most of the cases have been reported with IV drugs of these nitrogen-containing bisphosphonates, although there are some more recent reports over the last couple of years related to denosumab as well. To illustrate some of the issues involved in the management of ONJ, I'll now focus on the bisphosphonate story in my comments that follow. As I've mentioned, the current literature indicates that most of the patients using IV bisphosphonate therapy may be at increased risk for developing ONJ after about 1 year on the medication, with the risk for ONJ increasing the longer period of time the IV bisphosphonate is administered. Now, there are exceptions to that, but that's a general guideline in clinical practice. By comparison, the risk of developing ONJ in patients taking oral bisphosphonates by mouth, appears to begin to increase about 3 years after therapy. Now, the dental management associated with ONJ doesn't begin when the problem develops. Rather, we work very hard to prevent ONJ from developing in the first place. And this is where the collaboration and communication among the dentist, the physician, and the patient is absolutely essential. A thorough dental examination and medically necessary dental treatment before the bisphosphonate or the denosumab begins can be a very successful way to minimize or even prevent the ONJ. Conditions in the mouth that the dental team looks for that are associated with increasing the risk for ONJ, again, a very small risk across all patients, but a risk nonetheless, is we look for deep cavities or severe gum disease. These are types of infections in the mouth, and these kinds of infections, if they're significantly advanced, can be associated with risk for developing ONJ. Also, if the patient is wearing dentures that are rubbing against the supporting areas of the gums or against the bone, this trauma can increase the risk of developing ONJ. There are other risk factors that we would consider as part of the dental management in order to more comprehensively treat the patient before the bisphosphonate or denosumab begins. For example, if the patient is older, or if the patient's been on long-term use of steroids, has a diabetic background, has a history of tobacco use, smoking tobacco, and even multiple myeloma itself with the bone changes that Dr. Raji mentioned. These are all additional risk factors that would cause the dental team to be very forward-thinking in the way they approach the pre-bisphosphonate dental management. Now, having said this, we know a lot more now than we did even 5 years ago related to prevention of ONJ and its management, but more research is needed in order to understand these risks. And so I would really put out a request that the patient be considering participating in clinical research trials, so that we can help advance this field and help take care of patients in the future. Now, despite our very careful attention before and during bisphosphonate therapy, however, ONJ can nonetheless occur in that small percentage of patients we talked about. Again, really less than 5% of these patients generally. And what typically happens is the patient may notice some pain in the gum or the tooth area, or the physician may notice some irritation that's showing some exposed bone when the physician or the nurse oncologist examines the patient. Pain is present initially most of the time, but certainly not all of the time. So it's very important that the patient who's receiving bisphosphonate or some of these other agents, that the mouth be carefully examined on a regular basis by the healthcare team. Now, if ONJ develops, the current thinking is generally conservative management. And this conservative management includes antibiotics, topical rinses with wound care agents such as a chlorhexidine rinse. If there's a very loose, superficial piece of bone that can be easily removed with very, very minor effort, then gentle removal of that spicule of bone, as we would call it, could be considered. There's some debate on the feasibility and the wisdom of discontinuing bisphosphonates in order to help these areas of ONJ heal. Again, I would like to stress that these bone-modifying agents, including bisphosphonates, have tremendous value long-term in protecting the bone. And so any discussion about changes in the approach on the medication should certainly be discussed with your oncologist. This discussion leads me again to emphasize how important and how valuable it is to both ask your questions and communicate any concerns you might have to your healthcare team at any stage in your medical treatment. Although management of myeloma can be complex and can involve many different clinicians, by its very nature, it's this comprehensive, coordinated approach that can make all the difference in the world relative to achieving very positive treatment outcomes. You, the patient, are really at the center of the team, and we as providers very much rely on your input to make sure that all of us are sharing the same information and working toward common goals. So please do let us know if you have any questions or concerns throughout your treatment. And so I'd like to summarize where we started about 9 minutes ago, that there are really superb resources, including cancer care, to patients and their families and to the cancer team. And we can use this very important information to guide the decision-making and treatments related to multiple myeloma and dental care. And it's this partnership between the patient and the family and the healthcare team that can lead to very positive results for the patient with really a very good quality of life for many years to come. I think I'll stop at that point, Carolyn, and turn the discussion back to you. Thank you again.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Peterson, for really just very informative and very helpful presentation to everybody on the call. And also, you're stressing the importance of the person living with myeloma and their family as being such an integral part of the team. So thank you very much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Stubblefield. Dr. Stubblefield is Associate Attending Physiatrist, Chief Rehabilitation Medicine Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Stubblefield is going to address the role of rehabilitation medicine, physical activity concerns, practical physical activity tips and suggestions, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Stubblefield.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's really my pleasure to be here. I get the fun part of this lecture. My major mission professionally is to restore function and quality of life to cancer patients. You can think of what I do as basically being a sports medicine doctor for cancer patients. On a day-to-day level, what I do is I evaluate and treat pain and functional issues in cancer patients. Now, being a rehabilitation physician means that you're really part of a team. And the team includes everybody from the oncologist and the surgeon, the radiation oncologist, but also the dentist, physical and occupational therapists, and a cadre of other people who are involved in you know, maximizing patients' function. When it comes to multiple myeloma, there are two major overriding issues that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. One of those issues involves bone pain, which we'll be talking about in a minute. And the other one involves nervous system dysfunction, specifically peripheral nervous system dysfunction or neuropathy. Now, with neuropathy, there are several issues that come up as a result of it. One of them is pain. Another one is weakness. And a third one is really dysfunction of gait and activities of daily living. Now, neuropathy in multiple myeloma can be caused by multiple myeloma itself. It can be caused by amyloid, or very commonly can be caused by the chemotherapies that we expose the patients to. The myeloma, is the reason it causes neuropathy is not always clear. It can be a sort of vasculitic damage to the blood vessels, or it can be reasons that just haven't really been explained. Amyloid is not always seen in multiple myeloma, but we do see it from time to time. That's an abnormal protein that it becomes deposited with the multiple myeloma. The chemotherapy, we still don't fully understand why certain chemotherapies do cause neuropathy, but it's fairly clear that they do. Bortezomib or Velcade, which is was explained by Dr. Rajay, is become a very important chemotherapeutic, is one that does it quite frequently. Thalidomide also causes a sensory neuropathy in a number of the patients who receive it, and even Revlimid rarely can cause a neuropathy. Other causes of neuropathy in patients with myeloma are actually things that you wouldn't normally think about. Compression of vertebrae in the back, which we'll talk about in a minute, can actually compress the spinal nerves, and damage to the spinal nerves can look very much like a neuropathy, even though it's actually what we would call a radiculopathy, and it can sometimes be clinically very difficult to tell the difference between a neuropathy and a radiculopathy, and this is where we, as rehabilitation physicians, often become very important in the care of the patient because we have ways of telling the difference between these two entities. The treatment of neuropathy in myeloma patients involves a variety of things. Physical therapy certainly can be instrumental, but it usually involves medications, nerve stabilizing agents such as pregabalin or duloxetine, sometimes opioids and a number of other agents. The other major overriding issue that we see is bone pain. Now, bone pain is usually a result of compression fractures in the spine. These are very common in myeloma patients. The good news about this is that not all compression fractures in the spine are symptomatic. In myeloma patients, as in other patients with osteoporosis, these compression fractures are often asymptomatic. We'll do MRIs on these patients, they'll have multiple compression fractures, and the patient didn't even know they had them. That's one very nice thing, if there's any good news in this at all. When we do see compression fractures that cause pain, they're usually self-limiting in pain. When they're not self-limiting, we have ways of treating them, such as Dr. Rajay mentioned, kyphoplasty, which is a way of injecting cement into the vertebral body. Rare that we would ever have to do surgery for a multiple myeloma patient. Radiation, only if there was special circumstances like epidural disease, and we usually can use pain medicines to treat the pain associated with it, and it will usually go away in time. Physical activity concerns. The biggest concern for most patients with multiple myeloma is fracture pain and also bony deformity. They're worried that over time they're going to have compression fractures of the spine that will cause them to look hunched over. Now, fortunately, that's relatively rare. Most patients with myeloma really aren't as fragile as they think they are. The treatments that we have today actually keep their function and quality of life good for very long periods of time. The fact that most compression fractures are asymptomatic is also likely to keep patients able to participate in physical activities at a relatively high level for relatively extended periods of time. When patients do have compression fractures, it's fairly easy to treat the majority of them in the majority of cases. Long bone fractures are more difficult situation to treat in these patients, and we need to look at the wrist fractures for long bone fractures. So, for instance, patients who develop shoulder pain may be at risk for having a fracture, and those would need to be addressed with imaging potentially. Patients with gnawing neck, mid-back, or lower back pain, particularly if it's not going away, would need to be addressed. Patients who develop pain radiating down their arm or their leg, this is sort of sciatic type pain, would also need to be addressed by a physician to see if that's going to be a problem going forward. Ways to start physical activity in patients who have multiple myeloma. Well, always the advice that we want to give patients is to start slowly. We have done extensive studies on patients with cancer at all stages of disease, and cancer is generally considered to be very good. Exercise is always considered to be good for cancer patients. It's been shown to have benefits in terms of improving stamina, decreasing risk of fractures, and doing a number of other things. But really, if we do it in a very regimented, slowly progressive way, if you try to do it too quickly, you do run a risk of increased fracture. It's generally best to do it with a licensed physical therapist. That may not be available to all patients in all places. They may try to do it with a trainer. We've had some difficulties when you try to do it with a trainer of them being potentially too aggressive. How do you know if you've done it too quickly? Well, usually you would feel sore the next day. That if you feel like you're sore, just general muscle fatigue, you've likely overdone it and you may want to back off. Any excessive pain is something that you might want to report to your physician. You may have evidence that now you've probably jarred something loose that may need to be addressed. Stabilization exercises of the spine, generally we do these with the spine in neutral. That means that you're not actually flexing or extending your spine. It's a sort of exercise you do laying on your back and bringing your knees to your chest, as opposed to doing a sit-up or a crunch. Progressive aerobic exercise. This has been one of the best studied exercises across multiple types of cancer. Again, this is the sort of thing we do slowly, progressively. As with all cancers, myeloma tends to progress slowly over time. So the exercises you were doing in 2012 may start presenting problems for you in 2013. So if you start developing new pain symptoms, even as you're progressing, you know, your program, your exercise program slowly, you're going to want to report these new problems to your physician. Often at our setup here at Sloan Kettering, the physicians are following patients every 6 weeks to 3 months. Sometimes our physical therapists are the first ones to pick up a new pain complaint from the patient, or their oncologist may say, they may report it to the oncologist, and the oncologist will send a patient into us for further evaluation. Quality of life concerns. You know, patients worry that multiple myeloma is going to leave them with multiple fractures, severe and unrelenting, untreatable pain, severe deformity, you know, poor quality of life. These are relatively rare. Most patients with multiple myeloma are controlled, at least in the early stages, as if this is a chronic disease. Surveillance and attention to bone health, neuropathy if it's present, and the functional needs will allow patients to enjoy generally rich, full lives. Certainly we have to set limits, particularly as the developed disease in the spine and the pelvis and the long bones. We will have to set weight-bearing sort of limitations on patients. That needs to be done by a physician who has some knowledge in doing this. Sometimes we will have to do radiation for patients, but most of the multiple myeloma patients that I'm following are still able to exercise, still able to do the vast majority of things that they wanted to. And most of them are, you know, relatively pain-free. They may need to be on medications, but it's not really limiting the majority of their day-to-day function. And I'm going to stop there.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Stubblefield, for an excellent presentation and lots of wonderful information and very practical and useful for everybody on the call. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Richard Dickens. Rick is a clinical supervisor. He's an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. He's our blood cancers program coordinator, mind-body project coordinator at Cancer Care. And Rick is going to review with you the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care. I'm now going to turn the program over to my colleague, Rick Dickens. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. For multiple myeloma patients and their families, numerous issues can impact your lives, such as concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will help loved ones. When in treatment, additional issues of self-esteem due to side effects as well as treatment-related fatigue can impact normal activities of daily living. These issues and others can create anxiety and uncertainty. And with chronic cancers over time, these stressors can impact the patient's health as well as the health of those providing support. That's why building relationships with all members of your healthcare team, as Dr. Peterson and Dr. Stubenfeld mentioned, is so important. It is helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. They are your primary treatment network, and you are the experts in your cancer and treatment. But you are the expert of your body and life. For that reason, mutual respect can go a long way to foster the best treatment care. It is also important to build a personal support network, usually consisting of family and friends from your neighborhood, your life, and your community center or house of worship. For many patients, it is hard to say, I need help. But for people who care about you, helping is one thing they can give. That is why building a support network is so important, and by reaching out to as many as possible, you help the caregivers to spread the help and thereby help themselves. Accepting changes are normal during treatment, can nurture your body and spirit, but stressors can also elicit feelings of sadness, anger, and frustration. What is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. This is when it is helpful to seek help of a social worker or other professionals from organizations such as Cancer Care. Cancer Care has over 40 oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help, such as building a phone tree to update your social network, creating a blog for those who are computer savvy, or mind-body-spirit techniques to calm the mind and relax the body during times of stress. Along with education and resources, we provide help for multiple myeloma patients through our door-to-door grant, which provides up to $600 annually for transportation. We also have counseling, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. Groups provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation you're not alone. Too many support groups, social supports, and getting to know your healthcare team can go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. With that, I'll close, Carolyn. I'm sure there's many questions and answers to follow.
Thank you very much, Rick, for just a very poignant and caring presentation about the services that people can access from Cancer Care. And now we do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our questions, all of our speakers on board right now. And if you could explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many questions as we can. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. For those of you on the web, may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question is from Jackie A. Your question, please.
Is that me?
Go ahead, please.
Regarding your door-to-door transportation service, I'm sure you agree that support groups for myeloma patients can be very beneficial. Does door-to-door transportation support people getting to support groups?
Thank you, Jackie, for that excellent question. And I'm going to ask Rick to address your question. Rick, if you could address that question.
Yeah, thank you, Jackie. That's a wonderful question. It gets asked many times. Unfortunately, at this time, it doesn't. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is that cancer care, we do a lot of telephone and online support groups, people who can't get to those social supports, such as face-to-face groups. Definitely, we work with our providers trying to get additional assistance, but right now the door-to-door grant is primarily for transportation expenses to the many doctor visits and such that people do have to go to with multiple myeloma.
And Jackie, it sounds like you might be connected to a local group that you really like going to. Sometimes those institutions do have a way of helping people to get to the group. So why don't you and I talk after the program and see if we can come up with some other helpful solutions for you so that you can continue what you do. But just for everyone on the call to realize that CancerCare does offer a telephone online groups for that very reason, just because of the challenges often of just the transportation costs or just the physical challenges of getting to a group, so that doing them on the telephone or online means that you don't then have to, of course, is the travel piece then is not there. But we hear you. We hear that you care about the group that you want to go to. So we'll see if we can come up with some solutions for you. Thank you. Our next question?
Thank you. Our next question is from Henry F. Your question, please.
Yes. This is for Dr. Rajay. Doctor, could you describe what the use of radiation would be in treatment of a large lytic lesion in a femur? And if it was treated with radiation, and it came back, it increased in size 6 years later, would you consider retreating it with radiation?
Well, thank you for that question. Dr. Rajay, could you address that?
So, Henry, that's a really good question. And, you know, lesions in long bones like the femur, large lytic lesions, are fairly common. It really depends on the lesion. And if the lesion is kind of coming to the outer part of the bone, which we call the cortex, you know, this being a weight-bearing bone, we worry about it fracturing. So part of the reason why you probably got radiation initially was to maintain the integrity of the femur, prevent the fracture, and hopefully get rid of the myeloma as well. If if it's come back after 6 years, it is very potentially possible that it can be re-irradiated. It also depends on how much of radiation has been given there in the past. But if there is any concern of fracture in a situation like this, we do recommend pinning such lesions. So you have to go through an orthopedic surgical procedure where a pin is placed in the femur because of the nature or the size of the lytic lesion.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. Our next question?
Thank you. Our next question is from Patricia W. Your question, please.
Yes, this is for Dr. Rajay. I was interested, I don't know if I'm saying it right, BRAF mutations. I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma stage 3 in 2008. I had had many basal and squamous cells before that. After the myeloma, they seem to increase greatly, and recently I just had an early stage melanoma. What can I do? And you were talking about trials, and to get checked for this BRAF mutation, I'm not sure, if I'm saying it correctly.
Thank you. That's an excellent question, Patricia. And Dr. Rajay, would you address that, please?
Yeah, so absolutely. No, that's a great question, and you're asking it exactly right. So, you know, melanoma has been associated certainly with the BRAF mutation. It has not been seen in the squamous cell cancer. So, to speak, as far as myeloma is concerned, Patricia, like I said, it's not that common. It's not like it is in the melanoma. But given that you have the melanoma and myeloma, it's certainly worth checking. What we would look for is on a bone marrow test, look for the BRAF mutation. Here at Mass General, we have what's called the snapshot analysis, and we're able to pick up the mutation from your bone marrow test on the myeloma cells. It's a fairly straightforward test. I don't think all institutions necessarily have it just as yet, but it's something which, certainly the samples can be sent over, and it's something which can be done.
Thank you. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Julia W. Your question, please.
Yes. I am wondering if there is that, I understand there's a subcutaneous drug to help with neuropathy in the feet and hands.
Yes. So you are absolutely right, Julia. You know, Velcade or bortezomib, we used to give it intravenously, and it's a very good drug for myeloma. It helps control myeloma quite well. But as you heard in the conversation earlier on, it does predispose people to neuropathy. Now, the same drug, Velcade, can be given under the skin. Typically, we give it in the belly or the arms or the thigh areas, and it's the same dosage. We just reconstitute it a little bit differently, so it's a little more concentrated. But it works just as well as Velcade does. And the neat thing about doing it by giving it to you under the skin is it decreases the incidence of neuropathy by about two-thirds. So it's not a new drug. It's the same old drug, but the same old drug given differently, which really minimizes the neurotoxicity.
Excellent. Thank you. Wow, that's very interesting. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Robin L. Your question, please.
Yes, I had a lesion in my lower left jaw, and it was taken out in my, then my oncologist wanted me to go to the take Zubeda, but I have advanced periodontal disease. So what can I do for the bones? And this is for Dr. Peterson.
Good question. And Dr. Peterson, can you address this in a general way that might be helpful?
Yes. If the lesion is diagnosed as ONJ and there are certain criteria that we utilize, there's different stages and different criteria that we use to classify the lesion. If it is ONJ per se, then we typically manage it conservatively. It may take months, in many months sometimes, for the lesion to completely heal, but the combination of antibiotics, local wound care, some rinses, some low-dose antimicrobials, careful management over time typically results in healing. Again, it may take many months, but it's really a conversation between you and your dental team and your oncology team. As I mentioned during my presentation, there can be some discussion about temporarily discontinuing the bone-modifying agent, but again, I stress the high value of these bone-modifying agents, such as bisphosphonates or denosumab, and so that decision would need to be made very, very carefully with all of the information at your disposal.
Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mary W. Your question, please.
Thank you all for this wonderful presentation. Before I was diagnosed with myeloma, I was diagnosed with osteoporosis. I have had 33 infusions of bisphosphonates. My question concerns some elements that I'm hearing a lot of research on, strontium and silicon in bone remodeling. I'm wondering if that would be advisable for a person with osteoporosis and myeloma.
Thank you, Mary, for that question. Dr. Rajay, are you able to address that?
Sure. So, you know, strontium has been tried in the past, Mary, but I would not necessarily advocate it for myeloma. Part of the reason being myeloma, as I mentioned earlier, is a bone marrow disease, and all of these drugs tend to go to the bone marrow and can cause a significant amount of toxicity. So I wouldn't necessarily go to these older bone remodeling agents just as yet. I think there's a lot of hope, though, and we are, in fact, we have a clinical trial where we're using a drug. This one is called, at the current time, it's still called ACE-011. So it does basically the same thing. Up until recently, we've used bisphosphonates, which work well for osteoporosis and myeloma bone disease by shutting down those osteoclasts or those cells which cause bone resorption. these other drugs now will help with bone formation. So they'll do exactly what strontium and silicon, et cetera, have been shown to do in other settings. So for myeloma, I wouldn't use those drugs, but I would wait to use some of these newer drugs. Anti-DKK1 is an example of it. ACE-011 is another example, and all of these are in clinical trials for myeloma as we speak.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Margaret M. Your question, please.
Yes. My question is, since your immune system when you have melanoma is low, can you get another cancer with this kind of melanoma cancer?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Again, Dr. O'Shea, would you address that?
So, you know, that's a great question. So myeloma, the immune system is certainly down. We don't necessarily see an increased risk of second cancers when we've looked kind of at population-based studies. We have certain drugs, and I did mention maintenance lenalidomide as one strategy for the treatment of myeloma, where we're beginning to see the development of second cancer. So although it's an immune-regulated disease, certainly not predisposed to other diseases. One thing we're certainly seeing, like the ONJ, which Dr. Peterson has so nicely described to us, you know, some of these are a reflection of people living longer with myeloma, being on treatment longer. We are beginning to see more patients with breast cancer, prostate cancer, but I don't believe it is secondary to them having had the cancer. It's probably a reflection of people living longer with myeloma that we're picking up some of these other second cancers.
Actually, there's a question from one of our online participants about lenalidomide. Dr. Roger mentioned lenalidomide as a drug that is being used for maintenance. With regard to this or other maintenance drugs, is there a norm as far as what to choose? So I think they're asking, how do you make that decision? And Dr. Roger, you could comment
on again, that. It's very individualistic. I think most of the data, though, there's more data with lenalidomide post-transplant for sure. With Velcade, there's not that much of data. There's just one clinical trial. There are some patients who, in fact, only respond to Velcade, so it would depend on patients, but most of us tend to use lenalidomide as maintenance. Some of us end up using Velcade only and only based on the fact that the patient's disease is more responsive to Velcade.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Michael R. Your question, please.
My question goes to a treatment question. I fractured my C4 several months ago, and I'm in the process of going through physical therapy, but the pain is still very intense. And one of the doctors mentioned about a cement that could be put in to assist that. Can they elaborate on that?
Dr. Stubblefield, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so I think you're talking about kyphoplasty or vertebroplasty. Now, I'm not sure that can be done safely as high as C4. That's usually done in the thoracic spine and lower because of the vertebral arteries. So that's not usually a procedure that's done up in the cervical spine. There's other treatments, though, that can be done to assist pain up there. They're usually, you know, when you have pain up in the cervical spine after a fracture, there's, other than just usual muscle-relaxing treatments, nerve stabilizers like pregabalin, gabapentin, duloxetine, and opioids, which obviously we use sometimes. Sometimes botulinum toxin injections for bad paraspinal muscle spasms can also be used. You know, it's individualized, but you'd have to look at the individual fracture to see what the pain is being caused by to really individualize treatment for that. But I'm not sure that kyphoplasty would be generally used up in the cervical spine.
And in terms of Michael assembling a team, then he would have his oncologist. He would want to have his oncologist.
Yeah, his. You know, unfortunately, we didn't talk about this too much, but not all hospitals have rehabilitation medicine physicians. So the oncologist, the neurosurgeon, should be able to give him more guidance on that. At least here at Sloan Kettering, we don't do kyphoplasties up in the cervical spine. It really starts in the upper thoracic spine and down.
And Dr. Roger, did you want to comment any further? Or?
No, I totally, completely agree with Dr. Stubblefield. You know, going up to C4, we typically wouldn't do a vertebral augmentation procedure such as a Kyphor or vertebroplasty, and really using some of the medicines which he has described would be the best bet, really.
Yeah, I'd also add, I mean, we loathe to do surgery if we can in multiple myeloma because the bone quality is generally not very high because treatments often involve steroids and because of just the nature of multiple myeloma itself. So we really, whenever we can, we want to go with conservative measures to control pain, as opposed to surgical measures to control pain, other than kyphoplasty or vertebroplasty.
Well, thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You've really been extraordinary. I want to thank all of you who've either queued up and asked a question online or asked a question on the telephone. Really extraordinary questions, really an amazing call. And really, it's a call that we want to do over and over again because I can see that we could continue all afternoon with your questions. I do want to say that this is a one-hour education program, and that planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So in that in mind, I just want to let you all know that although the program will be soon ending, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those will continue really endlessly for you. And you can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, or 1-800-813-4673. And we simply are a telephone call away. So if you didn't get to ask a question or have some follow-up questions you want to ask, please do call our staff here. Also, just to do a quick review of our services, we do offer this practical and financial assistance. We offer counseling services on the telephone online. We have a staff of 45 master's level trained oncology social workers who are here to really answer your questions, help you, provide you support, and help in coping. We also have these workshops that we offer quite regularly, as well as actually materials that you can access from our website or we can send them to you. So it's a good place to have access to. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with multiple myeloma or in coping with your cancer. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we are simply a telephone call away, or you can visit our website as well. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.